Hello, friends, and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm your host, Rita Peters, along with my co-host, Mark Meckler, who joins us most weeks from his home near Austin, Texas. Mark, how are you?
I am doing great. I'm super excited about this morning's topic. This is something I've become really passionate about in the last couple of years, Rita, and I think most people who are listening probably have never even heard of it, but they should.
Yeah, I know zero about this topic, Mark, so I'm really excited to hear from our guest and learn more about it. But I think you know more about it than I do, so why don't you introduce our guest and get us started today?
Sure. Our guest is Margaret Byfield, and she's the founder of American Stewards of Liberty, and I would call them the premier group in the United States of America working to protect private property rights. You know, we all know, and we've talked about this before, Rita, that the government's intruding on a lot of our rights and overreaching and doing things they shouldn't do. One of the things most people don't realize is how intensely they're intruding on our private property rights, telling you what you can and can't do with your own property. The federal government is actually taking over a lot of property as well. And there's something called the 30 by 30 plan, whereby the federal government says it's their intent to control 30% of the United States landmass and 30% of water resources by 2030. And as if that's not bad enough, they say by 2050, it should be 50%. And what that means is it's going to take those property rights away from you. Not just your own personal property rights, not just what you can do with your house or your land. And I know, Rita, not long ago, you moved to the country, you have some acreage. They want to tell you what you can do with that. And they want to seize control of a lot of property, not just private property, but public property as well. In other words, places in your local community that you might use now that might become unusable, waterways that you might use that might become unusable, hunting grounds where you or your family might hunt or fish that might become unusable. This is a massive plan, and it not just affects the United States. It actually comes out of the World Economic Forum. This is an international plan by the elitist to take property rights away from us. And from my perspective, property rights are fundamental. They're biblical. I, as a person of faith, believe in private property rights. I believe they're rooted in the Bible. We find them in the Old Testament. And so this is a fundamental incursion, not just on our rights as Americans, but our rights as Christians, as human beings endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. So Margaret and her husband, Dan, have been fighting this fight for a long time. And we're really excited to have Margaret on the show to tell us a little bit about it. Thanks for being with us, Margaret.
Hey, thank you, Mark, and appreciate that rundown and introduction. That was pretty good.
I've been listening to you for a while, Margaret.
You've been a quick study, I'll tell you, because this is an issue that really can be pretty complex and hard for people to get their arms around. But you did great.
So here's where I'd like to jump in. I want to jump in kind of for you at the beginning. I know your story. I know you grew up on a ranch. And the government's intervention in your family's ranching operation is what first gave you a glimpse into this issue. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, sure. So my family purchased a ranch in 1978 in Nevada. What most people in the East don't understand about our Western land issues is that 50% of the West is owned by the federal government. So in the state of Nevada, 87% of the state is owned by government, local, state, and federal, mostly federal. So that means you have 13% of the state that's actually owned by the people. And so we had a typical Nevada ranch, and that means it was a combination of private deeded lands plus the rights to graze the federal allotments. And on all of that, we owned all the water. So when the West was settled, the first thing you settled and you appropriated was the water. And so those rights are still largely privately owned in the West by somebody other than the federal government. And so we owned all the water. Well, one of the first things the Forest Service did, the U.S. Forest Service, was they filed an application for all of our water rights, and then they used their regulatory powers through the grazing regulations to drive us off the land. And so they have that administrative power to do those kind of things. And so we fought them for 13 years. We won 3 administrative appeals cases against them and the Bureau of Land Management in that process. But by 13 years, they really had us out of business. And so my parents decided that the key question that needed to be answered was, what did a landowner in the West own or not own? on these federal lands. So in 1992 or 1991, they filed the first federal lands grazing takings case against the U.S. government. And we won every round of that case except the last one. So we actually won a compensation award from the U.S. Court of Federal Claims in Washington, D.C. for $14.4 million for the taking of our property, both physical and regulatory. But that was overturned at the D.C. Circuit. And really what happened, the best way to explain it, is our case got before three Eastern judges who had no concept of federal lands issues. So it was a lot easier just to buy the federal argument. They could make sense of that. So they ended up never deciding the question of what we owned, which is what we were trying to accomplish. But they decided, they kicked our case out and said that we didn't have standing or ripeness. Of course, that's after being in court for 27 years in this case. And so they really punted. I think it was just such a difficult issue for them to get their arms around. And if we had prevailed, it would have completely changed how property is owned in the West and how much it would have taken so much power away from the administrative agencies. So there was a lot at stake with that case. So I think there's a lot of reasons that didn't go forward. At the end of the day, we were not compensated. Obviously, we didn't win the case, and we no longer have the ranch.
Wow.
Yeah, go ahead, Rita. I know I've heard the story a bunch of times, and it still takes my breath away. So I'm sure there's a million things swirling in your head right now.
Well, first of all, I'm just shocked by the injustice of it, just the straight injustice of that you would not be compensated for the taking of all the, you know, effective, beneficial use of your land. But I just want to make sure our audience understands that, you know, you talked about being in court that long and pursuing this case, which really would have been for the public good to have, you know, a decision in your favor would have helped so many people. But all this time you're pursuing this case, I mean, I assume your family is paying attorneys and court costs. I can't even imagine the expense of having to pursue that while your land is being taken. You're being forced to stop your farming operations. It's just a terrible injustice, Margaret.
Well, we were very fortunate. We had a couple of attorneys who were just beyond being great attorneys, they were great people. And so most of the work that they did on our case, they did really pro bono, really, in essence, because they were depending on us winning the case, and that was actually going to pay the legal bills. But Mike Van Zandt out of California and Lad Bedford were our two attorneys there, and they were phenomenal. And boy, they really contributed so much to this. And they're the ones who really, I think, suffered a lot in this because they never were fully compensated. But the other part of this, though, is our story was pretty public. My dad wrote a book in 1989 called Storm Over Rangelands, which still today, when I go out and speak in the West, you know, I'll have somebody come up to me and say, your dad wrote the Bible on property rights of the West. You know, it's still really a very, very good book. And so our profile was pretty high. And what I think what we have to understand is people know our story because our profile was high. There are hundreds, probably thousands of landowners in the West who have gone through the same thing and have silently just had to give it up. And that's the real injustice from my perspective. And that's really the heart behind our organization. That's what we're trying to prevent happening in the future, which is why we do what we do today.
Yeah, you know, the story kind of makes my blood boil. I live out here in the West. I understand exactly what you're talking about. I originally come from California. I lived in the mountains in Northern California. I remember looking at topographic maps, and the first time I started doing that and realizing the topo looks like a checkerboard, and the checkerboard represents private property versus public property, federal lands ownership. And it's unbelievable how much federal land is out there. Federal government was never intended to own land like this. This is something that's an constitutional aberration. They breached agreements with the states that they made with the states. so it just really frustrates me. And then take that down to an individual level, like you talk about your story and all the people who didn't have the resources, don't have the attorneys to fight this stuff, essentially get steamrolled by the federal government. To me, it sounds like something out of a Old West melodrama. You know, maybe the cattle baron or the railroads come in and take over. Instead, it's the evil federal government twirling its mustache and laughing as they crush you. And when you think that this ends up in the DC circuit, like we all know, because we deal with this stuff a lot, these kind of politics, Rita and I, that if you're in the DC circuit, you're probably going to lose if you're just a citizen. If you're a citizen against the government, the DC circuit itself is highly biased in favor of the government. And so the fact that these cases are even adjudicated out in DC is obviously a fundamental problem. So you have this personal story. How does that turn into American Stewards for Liberty and you fighting for this for many, many decades now?
Well, when we filed the case, we actually started the organization Stewards of the Range, which then merged with my husband's organization, American Land Foundation, here in Texas, and we created American Stewards of Liberty some years later. So both Dan and I have been very active on the property rights, on these property rights issues since the early 1990s. And we have just fought over that time. We've just have taken on those big battles. So there's a, you know, an issue in Texas that we fought, the Trans-Texas Corridor, which was the first leg of the NAFTA Superhighway. If you're familiar with that, that's some years back, but we have a particular strategy that we can utilize and help local governments actually stop these things in their community, which on big national issues like that, if you can get one roadblock in it, which for us was Bell County, Texas, that put in this strategy that we utilize and we got it stopped. So we do this and we've been working on these national issues for the past 30 years. And probably because of our history, it always seems that we get put on our plate those big issues that nobody else really wants to deal with. And that seem like you can't beat them. They're too big to beat. And that's really where the key issue that we started fighting in the Biden administration is the 30 by 30 agenda. And we
can
knew,
you explain what that is, what 30 by 30 is? Because I'm sure I didn't know about this. I'm sure most of our viewers and listeners are unaware of this.
Yeah, so it's an international agenda, as you pointed out, to permanently protect 30% of our lands and oceans by 2030. So when they initiated this 6 days into Biden's administration, they said at that time, only 12% of America's lands were permanently protected. So about 300 million acres. And what they were seeking was another 400 million acres or 18% by 2030. Governor Ricketts, now Senator Ricketts from Nebraska at the time, he was our lead state governor who really led the states to oppose this early on. And he said, this is the equivalent of protecting one state in Nebraska every year for the next 9 years. Or two states of Texas. It is massive what they're trying to do. Now, they sell this program as this is about conservation and restoration. Okay, so you always have to understand that these big agendas that they're trying to cover come with a narrative that they think the general public is going to buy. So they use the climate crisis as the crisis, the reasoning this must be done now before anybody can really think about what we're doing. And then they cover it in this idea of conservation, meaning this really good thing that everybody's going to buy into. And so that's how they pitch it. It's a conservation program. But what they are doing, what really the agenda is about, when you watch the details and watch what they're doing, it is about getting control of the land permanently, so that we, the people, aren't making the decisions on what happens on our land, but the consolidated forces, whether they be the environmental organizations, which are very, very active in locking up our land through different devices, particularly through the conservation easement on private land. We can talk about that a little bit more if you want to go there. But they're doing it, it's a consolidation of getting control of or actual ownership of our land into the hands of the environmental organizations and government to be controlled by the global elites. And I think that, you know, Mark, as you pointed out, what most people don't understand in our modern day was very apparent to the point that the founders didn't even really have to say this out loud, but how important property is to our ability to defend our liberties and control our government. And so when America was settled, you know, they developed an incredible constitution and Bill of Rights that was dependent on we the people protecting it. And so the mechanism that they put in place so that we the people could always protect those rights was our ability to own the land. So you think about the Louisiana Purchase. When Jefferson made that purchase from France, that was 540 million acres. Every acre was disposed to the citizens. So a person could go out and they could acquire 120 acres in possibly one state, 640 in another state, depending on what it took in that area to make an economic unit for a family to survive. And that did a couple of key things. First off, it made every individual self-sufficient. You could grow your own food. You could create your own product to be to create wealth and establish your own wealth. And you could build a home and you could protect that home. You could defend that property. And in so doing, that gave the people the power and the power to limit the government. So it meant we could always make sure we had those individual liberties and we could always control the power of the government, primarily because they didn't have control or ownership of the resources in order to generate their own wealth and not need the voice of the people anymore. And that's really where we are. And so that was the policy until the West was settled. And that's when we have an article on our website called Climate Crisis Robber Barons. And that's where we tell the story of how that took place. And it was the robber barons that ultimately decided we can't have this competition if the West was actually developed in privately and all those resources were put into the private market, they would lose power. And they knew that. And so they actually influenced the start of the conservation agenda, the environmental agenda in America, and the progressive agenda. And that's what really led to the 50% of the West being locked up in federal control.
So I want to dive into a little bit of specifics here, if we could, because we're kind of talking at the 30,000 foot level, which is good to give people an overview. But you did mention something which sounds really appealing, actually, which is this idea of conservation easements. And these are tax benefits to people who are willing to put their property under a permanent, irrevocable easement, a protected, undeveloped. It sounds good for people who have big parcels of land. Sometimes farmers will do this. Again, the language is benign and the language is positive to most people when you hear conservation easement. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that's being used to take the private sector?
Yeah, that's a really good point. This is probably one of the most deceptive tools that the environmentalists have really pushed on landowners, because it does sound really good. And but it was actually devised as a way to get around the Fifth Amendment. So in other words, the environmental agenda, Dad said this years and years ago when we were in the middle of our fight, he told me, he said, remember, the environmental movement is not about whether we're going to use our resources. It's about who is going to use our resources. Mm-hmm. So they actually came up with this concept of a conservation easement because they knew they could never go out and buy all the private property. There'd never be enough money for that. But the conservation easement was the device that would allow them to get functional control, primary control over the private property, with the landowner thinking they still really own it. And so they created this conservation easement. But the other thing they did is they misnamed it. The device in law that it actually fits is something called a conservation servitude. The reason is because the conservation easement makes the easement holder the primary owner of the land, and the landowner the servient owner now, the serf on his own land. So he still has possessory interest, and he can still pay the taxes. But when you do the conservation easement, when a landowner does this, what they're selling to the land trust or the government is the development right. And that goes on the land trust balance sheet. So you can go to the Nature Conservancy's balance sheet and you will see a line item of how much they own and the value of all their conservation easements worldwide. That is their right. Now it's their property. And with that is developed a conservation purpose. So to get the tax deductions for the IRS to give the tax deductions, which is what makes this, you know, appealing to landowners, then they have to have a conservation purpose, which permanently protects that land. And so that conservation purpose now controls everything that goes on that property. And there's a list of restrictions that the landowner signs onto when they sign that contract. And that list of restrictions is in perpetuity. So they have to decide how many homes they will build on that house. If they want to cut out an extra one for their kids to come back and build a home on that property, that has to be written into that contract. Mm-hmm. And if it's not written into that contract, it doesn't happen. And so remember, they're creating these easements in perpetuity. So you're making that decision not only for your generation, but your children's, your grandchildren's. Way down the line, you have completely restricted that property. And the land, it's been a brilliant tool for the land trust to use to get control of the property. And this is one of the reasons why, when I talked about that 12%, what makes up that 12% of lands that are permanently protected, that is our national parks, our national wildlife refuges, wilderness areas, and conservation easements in perpetuity. And I think a lot of landowners were very surprised by that. We were not, because we understand the conservation easement eliminates the private property. It's your right to put that conservation easement on your land. Just understand, once you do, it's no longer private property.
So let me just, Margaret, get clarity about something, because when I read about this 30 by 30 program, I looked it up online. And it talks about conserving 30% of U.S. lands by 2030. What does it mean by U.S. lands? Because someone reading that could think about, oh, it just means, you know, conserving 30% of the lands that are already U.S. property anyway. So can you just clarify that for us?
Yeah, they mean all lands in America. The territory of the United States. So to the 12% figure that I told you that they said was permanently protected, the federal government owns approximately 27-28% of our land base. So right now that tells you we're not talking about ownership, we're talking about level of restriction to meet that definition. The other thing that they said, which was very concerning to them, is that most of the high-value property and biodiversity is on private lands in America, which tells you right up front, obviously, the federal government isn't a very good land manager, which if you live in the West, you know that. But it's the private land owner who has taken such great care of that land, because he's personally on that land, he personally benefits from that land, and he's going to turn that over to the next generation better than how he got it. That's the nature of a private landowner. Mm-hmm. And so they know the most valuable lands, the lands best for species, the lands best for all of, for wildlife, are our private lands. Well, out of that 12%, only 1% of those, of that figure, they say are permanently protected, meaning they have control of them. Those are the conservation easements in perpetuity. And so that concerns them. So a huge target and huge part of their agenda is to get control of the private land. They already have control of the federal land. It's pretty easy for them just to continue increasing restrictions so that they can get that batch of land permanently protected. And they are well on their way doing that through the Biden administration, through a number of different vehicles. But it's the private land that's a huge target of theirs. Mm. So we've seen a huge effort of the Biden administration to pour a ton of conservation dollars into private land conservation programs, which creates a federal nexus on the private land through that federal funding and triggers other federal laws that otherwise would not come into play, which allow them to restrict that private land. So they're through the first 3 years, we've seen them basically throw out the net of conservation dollars. They've made it very appealing for landowners to sign up for this free money. And then once that federal nexus is on the land, they have a whole other bevy of tools they can use to lock down that land to get to that point where they can control 30%, permanently protect 30% of our land.
Wow.
Yeah. Margaret, one of the things that really fascinated me was, obviously, we think of land having a value, fair market value in an open market. And one of the things that I've heard from you and others in the space is that because of the federal government flowing through these programs, a lot of times they'll get farmers to lock down their land, or land gets purchased into land trust at way above normal fair market value. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I'll tell you the real damaging thing that's happening to our economy through all these federal dollars coming in. And first off, we have to, you know, people will say, well, those are our taxpayer dollars. And I say, no, it isn't. Those are debt dollars. We're way beyond spending. You know, this is dollars that we owed China when we put these conservation programs on. Yeah. By pouring all of this federal money into the marketplace like this, you have a couple things happen. First off, it becomes more profitable for landowners to set their land aside and let it grow fallow than to put it into production. So two things happen. Number one, the federal government dollars are directly competing with the working landowner who's trying to put food on our table, because they can't afford to rent that land from that landowner and pay the same amount of money that the government is paying him to keep it off. So that lowers production, which then increases property taxes. It increases food prices. I mean, it actually impacts every person in America by doing that, by changing the marketplace. So the federal dollars.
Margaret, I want to interrupt here for a second and step this down to a very simple level so people understand exactly what you're talking about. If I'm grazing cattle on my land and I've got a ranch and you've got a ranch next door and you've got a bunch of unused grazing land, I want to expand my herd. I want to expand my ability to graze my cattle. I might lease land from you, essentially open up the fence. I'm going to put my cattle onto your land and graze them. And I'm growing cattle for slaughter and consumption of the public. But what happens is the federal government comes in and says to that landowner next door, well, look, you can rent it for X dollars an acre. You can lease it out to your neighbor, but we'll pay you 3X not to do that. So suddenly your neighbor is incentivized not to lease grazing land to you. Same could be true for growing crops, not to lease to you, but instead to lock it down and not use it. And that restricts food production, and it artificially increases the price of the use of land. Is that an accurate description?
That is so accurate. And then the other part of that is you have to think about it. What does it do to the local economy? So when you reduce the production and you're reducing the value of the land, so that reduces how much it can be taxed. And then if you're not putting that good into the community, then you're not getting that turnover dollar that fuels the local economy. And so in these areas where there's a lot of conservation lands, you find that the counties are having a hard time paying for the hospitals, for the schools, for road maintenance, and emergency services, because their tax base has just been artificially reduced. And the other thing, getting back to conservation easements, is the number that we keep hearing universally is that easement reduces the property value by 40%. So Department of Revenue in Nebraska did a study about this, and they found that it reduced the property by 40%. So then that reduces that value of how much the county can tax that land. And then that means they're going to have to increase the value of how much they tax on everybody else's land to make up for that. Right. So we don't understand how detrimental these conservation programs are to the local economy. One of the things we have thrown out there is, you know, counties ought to, and states really ought to be doing something like saying only 10% of land can be in conservation in any county. Mm-hmm. And limit that amount so that the local governments can still be self-sustaining. I mean, ultimately, isn't that where we want to be? We want to be to that place where the states have their sovereignty and are not relying on federal dollars to operate. But that has to begin at the local level. The counties need to be able to do that. But what these conservation dollars are doing is they're creating a dependency program for the private landowner, for the local governments, and for the states because they have eliminated our private property rights and our ability to produce from our own land, and they have taken those rights away from us.
Margaret, this has been so educational and informative for me, and I hope for our audience as well. Unfortunately, we're already out of time. But before I close, can you just tell our audience where they can go to find out more information about this and what they can do to help?
Yeah, our website is AmericanStewards.us. And I would recommend that you just sign up for our newsletter to get started and see what we do. We have a biweekly publication that we come out with online that really just highlights the key things going on the property rights issue front. Sometimes they're national stories, sometimes they're local stories, but it'll keep you apprised and you will start seeing the magnitude of what they are doing and all the tools they're using. That is, I think, probably the best thing to do right now. And then we will alert you when key things are happening that where we could use your help to help us push back things.
Great. Margaret Byfield, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I also want to thank our generous sponsors at Blue Ridge Chimney Services, Blessings Christian Bookstore, Sunshine Ministries with Christian Radio, Wishing Well Florists and Travel Services, and New Beginnings Church and Garber's Church of the Brethren in Harrisonburg. Thanks everyone for listening. If you'd like to donation to help keep Crossroads on the air, you can send a check to Crossroads at P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, Virginia 22803. I'm Rita Peters with Mark Meckler, inviting you to join us again next week for another edition of Crossroads, where faith and culture meet.
Thank you for listening to the Crossroads podcast. To learn more about Convention of States, go to conventionofstates.com.